From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, the National Governors Association's annual meeting begins tomorrow in Milwaukee. We'll get a preview of the agenda, which includes an initiative to hire more people with disabilities. We then meet Cindy Alioto, who doesn't let her blindness hold her back. She has a full-time job, and she also volunteers at four area organizations.
I've seen a lot of people who think they can't do it because they're blind, and they try and play the blind card, we call it. No, just put on your big boy pants or big girl pants and get out there and do it.
Later, composer and musician Nathan Meckel finds himself recording an album of kids' music. And the Milwaukee Comedy Fest turns 8 and is overwhelmed by good submissions.
How do you choose one funny over another? I mean, it was really difficult, but, you know, at the same time, that's a really good problem to have.
Stay tuned for Lake Effect on WUWM, but first the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. The National Governors Association is holding its annual meeting in Milwaukee this year, hosted by Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker. It begins tomorrow morning, and it gives the nation's governors a chance to meet in an informal setting to discuss issues and strategies, and also gives them a chance to socialize and explore Milwaukee as well. Marge Pitroff is WUWM's news director, and she joins me now to give us an overview. Good morning, Marge. How are you?
Fine, Bonnie. Thanks. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you as well. Thanks for stopping by. Let's begin with what the National Governors Association is.
Well, Bonnie, the association formed more than a century ago. The nation's governors have gotten together to just talk about common concerns, maybe share things they've tried, how well they're working, and I guess just to a lot of times vent at the federal government. The states are always trying to balance budgets, and then they feel these programs coming down from on high and huge issues that they need to tackle. And so a lot of times I think they just socialize, vent, as I said, at the federal government and, get to know each other across party lines. They don't always meet that way. A lot of times it's with just members of their own parties.
So is that part of the reason for the annual meeting is a chance for people to get to know each other who might not otherwise do so?
Yeah, from everything I've heard, it's largely a social gathering. We spoke to a few governors who have attended these in the past. But, of course, there are important topics. One of the biggies this year, as you might expect, is health care with the national reforms coming down and a lot of the responsibilities falling on the states. The governors are grappling with how to do this, whether to expand Medicaid, how to hold down costs. Governor Walker has decided that Wisconsin won't create its own exchange and he will not expand Medicaid to the full limit that it could. So, you know, he will be sharing his decisions and his reasoning and others that are going along with the federal template. Of course, we'll talk about what they're experiencing.
Are there other topics that are coming up?
There are, Bonnie. Of course, education and developing the workforce. That's a huge one on most governors' minds. And just creating jobs. They all want to be job creators. And I know there's sometimes some competition, as we've seen in Wisconsin. You know, the state trying to lure from Illinois, Minnesota trying to lure from Wisconsin. So I would guess this would be a little more friendly. Infrastructure needs, that's also on the agenda, particularly among the states that have experienced tornadoes and flooding, hurricanes. In fact, the U.S. Secretary of Transportation is going to be at the conference to talk about best way to maintain roads and bridges and also repair things and how to come up with all the money involved.
Even though this is not really a policy-making conference, do governors come away with ideas that have since turned into policy in their own states?
I think they do agree, perhaps, on policies and issues that they want to raise to the federal government. You know, hey, look, we're out here having trouble with this. And then also the leaders of the Governors Association can also come up with agenda items. And the current chair of the association, he came up with an item for the association to deal with over the past year, and he announced it in February in Washington when they met in their annual winter meeting, and it's employing people with disabilities. And he really wanted the governors and business people that work at the state level to talk about how they can make progress in employing people who have disabilities. And so I'm certain that he will want an update on the progress the states are making in that regard.
Well, who will be here? Do all of the governors attend, or it depends on what's happening at home?
I would assume the latter, Bonnie. We haven't gotten a list yet of who will all attend. Of course, Governor Walker is going to host the event. He'll be there. We've heard that perhaps New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal might be there. And the three of them, of course, have all been mentioned as potential candidates for president in 2016. And we'd also heard that perhaps former president and Governor Bill Clinton will be addressing the governors. Of course, in addition to the state and federal leaders, business people are going to be schmoozing. I know the MMAC, the Milwaukee Association of Commerce, is going to have members there escorting the governors to some of the places they go, such as Discovery World and the Harley-Davidson Museum. And they want to drop hints of what they believe they need to create jobs and to compete globally. And then, of course, there'll be protesters outside the group Occupy Milwaukee and a few others. They're upset particularly with Republican governors for what they say is favoring the rights of business over the rights of citizens. And we received a news release in the newsroom not all that long ago from union members that they're going to lobby the governors to do what they can to buy American and adopt those types of policies for state and local purchases.
So it looks like it's going to be an interesting weekend for Milwaukee.
It certainly will. And hopefully the sun will be shining and our city will look as beautiful as it is.
Well, Marge Petroff, as always, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Bonnie.
Marge Petroff is WUWM's news director. The National Governors Association's annual meeting begins tomorrow in Milwaukee, and it runs through the weekend. Our newsroom will file further reports as the weekend progresses. You can access them all at WUWM.com. As Marge mentioned, one of these sessions at the meeting will focus on employing people with disabilities. That initiative was created by the association's chair, Governor Jack Markell of Delaware. He says people with disabilities have untapped talents that can contribute to businesses and communities, and state governments need to help them overcome the various obstacles to getting jobs. It's an issue Wisconsinite Cindy Alioto knows about firsthand. She's blind and has faced many challenges in a world that's geared towards sighted people. But she hasn't let them stop her. Rather, she holds down a full-time job and spends much of her spare time volunteering for four different organizations. Back in May, Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke asked her how she, as someone who lost her sight over time, tries today to convince people that being blind isn't a liability.
To me, it's not a big deal because I grew up around blind people. My sister was blind since birth. My brother lost his sight when he was in second grade. And my parents never treated us any differently. So people said when I lost my sight, they go, "Aren't you devastated?" I said, "No, it's not a big deal. It's you just need to adapt." My big thing is everything can be done with adaptation. So it's not a big deal.
And if I understand correctly, you started losing your vision when you were a teenager.
Right. I sideswiped a parked car and they realized I couldn't see.
Well, how long did that adaptation take you?
16, they realized I had the same eye disease as my brother and sister. They had first told my parents I didn't. Then they told my parents by the time I was 30, I'd be totally blind. But I didn't go totally blind till I was about 48.
Well, so you had quite a while to adapt to
it
this.
Slowly decreased, yes.
So if it's not a liability, do you feel like are there aspects to your situation that have their advantages?
Yes, because I look at things totally different. I appreciate things more. I hear, you know, people say your hearing gets better when you're blind, but it's not that. It's you pay attention more. So you hear everything and take everything in.
And you worked for, I guess, three decades in customer service for a sheet music publisher. And,
yes.
And now you work for Industries for the Blind mm-hmm. as a sales associate. Do you think that hearing things more or paying closer attention actually serves you in good stead in a way that others might not have that ability?
I think so. I pay attention more. I you have to pay attention more. So I think I retain more because I pay attention more.
And if I understand correctly, you left your previous job, you essentially downsized out of it, correct?
They downsized me out, yes.
How did you come to work for Industries for the Blind?
Well, I was job hunting, and the world out there is not very blind friendly when it comes to finding jobs. People didn't want to take the time to try and adapt their businesses to help the blind or get the equipment or anything like that. So a friend of mine who worked at industry said, "Hey, come here." And I said, "Oh my gosh, if they don't hire me, I'm really in trouble." So I started out in piece rate for 7 months. Then I moved to brush department as a squeegee master. And then they found out that I had 30 years of customer service experience. And within 2 weeks, I was moved into the office. So And I've, like I said, just got promoted to inside sales associate. So it's upward mobility at Industries for the Blind.
As someone who had 3 decades of customer service experience, Squeegee Master must have been kind of a bring down.
Well, you know what? I am so glad that I had to work out on the floor in piece rate and Squeegee because I really understand what they do out there, and my hands were so sore. I was working in an office all my life, and it was humbling.
As you say, there seems to be a lot of work to do convincing employers to adapt themselves.
Mm-hmm.
What's the argument you make to them? Why should they go to the trouble?
Because I personally think disabled people give 110% when they're working. They will always be there. They try their hardest. If you can adapt whatever you need them to do, they will do it.
You work in an industry, obviously, that for a company that hires others with vision loss.
Yes.
Are there attitudes that you sometimes encounter among your coworkers that they have things to overcome as well?
Oh, yes, there always is. And it's the people who are losing their sight, it's the biggest stepping stone for them to realize they really can do it. They just have to get over that stepping stone.
You not only do this inside sales associate job for Industries for the Blind, but I gather you are also a pretty active volunteer. What role do you see volunteering playing in your life?
Major. Talk to my husband. Major. I am volunteering in 4 different organizations. I love it.
Who are you volunteering for?
I am the treasurer for the Milwaukee Beer Barrels Blind Bowling League. I am the chairman of the Recreation and Welfare Committee at Vision Forward. I am the chairman of the fundraising committee for BOLD, which is Blind Outdoor Leisure Development. And I am the secretary for the West Dallas Central Lions Club.
How vital a role do volunteers play in each of those? I know Vision Forward, for example, has dozens of volunteers.
They do. I'm one of the, I don't want to say few, but I am one of the blind volunteers there. There's quite a few sighted volunteers, but I am the only totally blind person on my committee, and I am in charge of it, which sets very good for Vision Forward that they put a totally blind person in charge of that. And I love it, and I have so much help, and everybody's wonderful. And they, you know, they have great volunteer opportunities there.
It must be significant to be someone without sight who is playing this leadership role. I mean, I would think it would be crucial for the organization to have someone like you that's doing this.
Yes, yes, it's a good thing for them. Plus, I'm also on the board. I just made the board this year, so I am on the board at Vision Forward now too.
Well, and you mentioned that you lead this particular committee. Tell me about the work you do.
Recreation Welfare. Once a month on a Saturday, we supply lunch for 40 people. Then we have our membership meeting. Then we supply lunch for 60 people. Then we do bingo, and then we supply intermission snacks, and then bingo again. So it's a full day, about a 10 to 12 hour day that we're there cooking, serving, helping, and making, letting them have fun. And so that's what me and my team do.
Well, and how large is your team that you're directing?
15 people. And I am the only totally blind one, and I think there's one visually impaired, but she can see pretty good. But I am everybody else is sighted under me.
What's the key challenge that you encounter?
You know, they're wonderful. I couldn't do it without them. I have 2 of the women, our sisters. They're my right and my left hand, and I could not do it without Sharon and Sue and the rest of the team. Everybody has a job. Everybody knows what they're doing, and it just runs like clockwork. We just enjoy. We have fun. It's a fun group.
Why is it important for you to do these things?
When my children were little, I was a Sunday school teacher for 13 years, Girl Scout leader for 11 years, and 5 years as my son's service project coordinator. And it was really cool because that's when I was losing my sight. So these kids saw how a disability didn't stop me, and they learned from it. And I got a letter from one of my Girl Scouts about a year ago. She's in college, and she was going on and on how she was so glad that she was in my troop and got to work with a disabled person because now she understands it and she has so much more awareness and compassion.
So, I mean, is it too much to say you could serve as a role model for people both with and without disabilities?
That has been said, yes. It has been said.
I think I'm saying it now.
Yes.
Do you feel like you have some responsibility to help others with vision problems come to the same conclusion that you did, that you have a lot to offer both the sighted and non-sighted community?
Funny you should say that. There are two examples I have is this one gentleman who 10 years ago was a football player at University of Clare who got a head injury and now is visually impaired. And we have gotten him involved in bowling, and he's just – he now has a job at Industries. He's come so far. He just is so thrilled that I've mentored him into becoming that – that disability isn't going to stop him. His famous line is, we do not have disabilities, we have possibilities. And then another woman who is losing her sight at Industries was very skittish about starting to use her cane. Well, I convinced her that you've got to embrace your blindness. And now she is the co-chairman with me for the Vision Walk, and we raise money for fighting blindness now.
What do you mean when you say embrace your blindness?
You have to embrace it because some people there's this plateau. When you're going blind, there's this plateau where you get stuck, and you don't want people to know that you can't see, and you don't want to start using that cane that spots you out. And little do you realize that's your eyes, and they have to realize that they have to embrace the blindness and go with it and start adapting. And not be afraid of it, because that's a big challenge.
You mentioned this athlete you worked with. One of the things that he's now doing is bowling, and you are, I think you said, treasurer mm-hmm. of the mm-hmm. is it the Milwaukee
Beer Barrels Blind Bowling.
A lot of bees in that. Mm-hmm. What bowling is this classic Milwaukee kind of activity? Mm-hmm. What do you get out of bowling?
The camaraderie. The satisfaction. Funny, we just had our state tournament this Saturday, getting prize money, winning first place, you know, getting the prize money, the camaraderie, knowing that you can do it. The same gentleman bowled his best game, 179 was his best game he's ever bowled at this tournament. He got first place in the doubles tournament. And, I mean, he cried when he got his trophy. He was just so – it just touched him so much that he now hit that level of he's an athlete again.
Well, and I think the first question you must get a lot when you tell people that you're involved in this bowling league is how do you do it?
We have rails set up that we just use to guide us. Number one, keeps us in the same right alley so you don't go in somebody else's alley. And it just guides you. That's the only adaptation we have is a rail just to keep us straight. Otherwise, we do it like anybody else.
What do you think the sighted world needs to learn about the non-sighted world and maybe vice versa?
The sighted world needs to know to give disabled people a chance. Just with a little adaptation, just give them a chance. We just lost our sight. We didn't lose anything else. We're just normal people.
And as someone who went from having sight to not having sight, are there things that people in the blind world ought to know about the sighted world?
That you can do it. I've seen a lot of people who think they can't do it because they're blind, and they try and play the blind card, we call it. And no, just put on your big boy pants or big girl pants and get out there and do it.
There's a certain level of assertiveness that needs to happen?
Yeah, they need to just be aggressive, yes.
What is your best bowling score?
138. My average is a 77.
Well, here's to many strikes down the road. And Cindy Alioto, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
Cindy Alioto is an inside sales associate for Industries for the Blind in West Allis. She also volunteers for a number of organizations, including the Milwaukee Beer Barrels Blind Bowling League and Vision Forward. There are links to more information about both of those groups from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Cindy Alioto first spoke with Mitch Teich in May. We'll take a short break now, and then when we return, we'll hear about new research in education standards and the Happy Racers return to Milwaukee. That's coming up next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. The National Governors Association meeting is just getting underway, but earlier this week, experts and officials from around the country gathered in Milwaukee for the Governmental Research Association's annual conference. Several sessions focused on education, and one highlighted standards and accountability. Lake Effect's Amy Kiley compiled viewpoints from that panel to provide an overview of the educational accountability debate.
The panelists of the Governmental Research Association's educational standards session are not afraid of accountability.
I feel accountable to my school board. I feel accountable to our kids. I feel accountable to DPI. I feel accountable to our teachers. I mean, there's accountability. There's enough accountability to go around and drive change.
We have school by school sometimes examples of what to do to change them and improve them, but we don't really have a sound, cohesive strategy.
In North Carolina, the pressure from the federal government on for accountability is not a whole lot different from the accountability pressure that was there that the state placed on itself starting in the 80s. So that's not really a change for us, but I think what we've gotten better at as a state is figuring out and understanding what does and doesn't work and what does and doesn't matter in those schools.
Heat and accountability push change, and they move change. My opinion is that the government ought to put broad parameters around that accountability and heat, and not prescription, because that needs to be driven down at the local level. The prescription should come at the local level.
Those speakers are Superintendent of the Wauwatosa School District, Philip Ertl, Kristen Pryor of the Center for Governmental Research, Tripp Stallings, an educational researcher at North Carolina State University, and Deputy State Superintendent Michael Thompson. When it comes to the source, extent, and type of accountability, the panelists' views are more variant. Here are the same four speakers in the same order.
There's locally elected school boards for a reason, and I think the authority of our locally elected school boards has been stripped away over time.
I really am torn on this. I don't have real clear convictions on the role of federal government versus rights of states.
We couldn't do without the federal role in education, even if we wanted to, and there's quite a few people in our state who would like to.
I would say if who should be in control, I'd say the teacher in a classroom, because that's the one who's right in front of those kids every single day. School district sets the condition that the teacher can flourish in.
Oversight is a hot topic in education right now, since the Common Core standards from the federal government are set to take effect soon. They'll standardize what students should know by what age and assessment of that knowledge. The panelists largely agree much of the outcry over the standards is founded on a misconception. Michael Thompson of the state DPI summarizes it.
The Common Core standards are not a curriculum. That happens at the local level.
That's
the instructional design to deliver the Common Core are at the local level. And the Common Core will, quite frankly, drive those type of instructional practices because they're at a higher level and they're deeper. And most people believe the Common Core. They don't like it because we're going to put a chip in everybody's neck, just a little one, and then track them around the world.
Beyond standards, the panelists also offer creative attempts to improve education. Kristen Pryor of the Center for Governmental Research is interested in emerging technology to close achievement gaps.
If we really shifted to using technology and instructional technology and kind of adaptive assessment in ways that really opened up individualized pathways and kind of shifted the teacher out of this monolithic approach of meeting everyone's needs sort of in the middle, not really, that we actually might really, really close those gaps.
Tripp Stallings of North Carolina State University praises attempts to make teachers like and stay in their jobs.
North Carolina does a teacher working conditions survey every other year, and it has a response rate of nearly 90%, which is phenomenal. But it's one of the richest sources of qualitative data we have in the state about what it means to be a teacher and what matters to them in their environments, and it's leadership.
Superintendent of the Wauwatosa School District, Philip Ertl, praises ideas that have become political debates.
Act 10 in Wisconsin, which was very unique as we went through it. And basically, I think it's going to make us a lot better. Freedom, I think that's the concept behind charter schools. I believe in choice within the public school system. We have four different STEM programs, a virtual charter school. So I think Act 10 and what's going on in Wisconsin is going to have a huge impact.
Michael Thompson of DPI wants a paradigm shift for accountability.
The federal government says, well, we can't trust the states because they'll game the system. And the state goes, well, we can't trust local school boards because they'll game the system. And maybe the school board goes, we can't trust those darn teachers in the classroom because they're just out in it for the money. Let's assume they're doing it right, and we'll be surprised if we catch them doing it wrong. Personally, I've not met an educator, a principal, a superintendent who's like, we're going to stick it to the kids.
All the panelists seem to agree that discussing education reform, standards, and accountability is a good start toward change. For Lake Effect, I'm Amy Kiley.
Lake Effect's Amy Kiley reported on the Educational Standards and Accountability Session at the Governmental Research Association's annual conference. John Strelecki provided engineering assistance. Early learning standards have been getting a lot of attention in recent years as studies continue to show that exposure to reading early on sets the stage for a child's future learning and literacy abilities. It's not just researchers who are trying to encourage early literacy, however. Many children's book authors are using the latest research to inform their stories to encourage young readers. Tomorrow, Concordia University in Wisconsin is holding an early childhood literacy festival where the keynote speaker will be the best-selling and award-winning children's author, Wisconsinite Barbara Josie. But children aren't just exposed to words and language through books, so joining her on stage will be Nathan Meckel, the founder of the family-friendly band The Happy Racers. Meckel recently collaborated with Josie, who wrote lyrics to several Happy Racers songs that go along with her books. Meckel, who hails from Tennessee, hadn't specifically set out in his musical career to create what he calls kindy rock, but he has no problem playing good music that kids can also enjoy. He joined Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in Studio C1 back in the winter to play a few tunes, including one he calls the Happy Racers theme song called Failure is a Myth.
Yeah, I said failure's a silly myth. Oh, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it. I don't believe it. Hey, 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 hey. I've been thinking about airplanes.
Nathan Meckel, welcome to Lake Effect. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. It's good to be here.
Did you ever imagine yourself an alt kids performer?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. Short answer, no.
So did it take arm twisting to get you into that mindset?
A little bit, and some hypnosis. A little bit. It was definitely a story of like, well, I'm going to try this out a little bit. My dad's in the music business and has worked with some educators and some things that have kind of led me down that road a little bit. And it started out kind of as, well, this is kind of a fun, sort of amusing break from the pop and the alternative and the indie records that I work on as a producer and writer. But then about halfway through, it's like it clicked and I really got it. And it's been just a real free experience to get into.
Well, I was wondering that because there are any number of kids, musicians or musicians for kids who started their careers and still often maintain careers in adult music. What is it that reaching an audience of younger people brings you that playing for more angst-ridden people, ridden people might not?
Well, a two-part answer. One part, you know, I had a phase where I was full of angst. That's just no fun. I want to have fun. Two, you know, it's hard to deny any kids just pure energy and excitement for the world and what they're all about and discovering new things. And so, you know, I have two kids that are in grade school and so I'm around that every day. And they're just, you know, it's hard not to – you hear laughter. It's contagious, right? So, you know, that really, it's all kind of about the kids. And when they get pumped up about music and if I can – you know, inspire anybody to want to write a song or play a guitar or turn them on to some rock and roll record, then great.
Do you think of yourself as, for lack of a better term, a gateway drug?
Yeah, I like that. I've never considered myself that, but I love that. I might use that as a status update later. That's great.
Well, there must be a little bit of pressure, though, when you think about, you know, you could be the first sort of entree into – you know, sort of more sophisticated music for some kids.
Absolutely, man. That's really where my passion lies. How far can I push the envelope of blurring the lines between is this kid's music, is this family music, what is this? And doing it in a way that's still smart, high quality of the lyrics, melodies, great productions. Absolutely. That's kind of what drives me. It's a challenge to be able to do that.
You mentioned that you have a couple of grade school kids, mm-hmm. and I gather that one of them is at least responsible for the name of this band.
That would be my daughter, Sophia. She's in the third grade. And when this started coming about, like, quite a few years ago, just started, you know, milling. I wrote a song. There was no project or band at any point. I was like, hey, if you ever had a band, what would you name it? She's just like, the Happy Racers. Like, I mean, literally like 3 seconds and it popped out of her mouth. And I went, oh, I'm going to hang on to that. A couple years later, insert band name. We went ahead and branded that long before we even had a record. there was no plan whatsoever. I just get up and make it up every day.
give us a little more background about yourself. Where does this this project, the Happy Racers, fall in the context of your broader career?
Sure. Well, great question. I'd love to know the answer to that. I think it feels like it's the beginning of something pretty awesome. And it maybe even took a year of me sort of denying or hiding or dodging that to finally go, you know, this might be really cool. Maybe I should focus on this more. I'm hoping, you know, one just personal goal, I would love to, you know, I really admire what Randy Newman does, if anybody's hip to what he does in the music world of songs for movies. And I've had, you know, in the pop world, in the regular, quote-unquote, regular music world as a writer-producer, I continue to be very active in that. I've had pushing 30 songs that have been in major networks and things like that, but I would love to get the opportunity to do what he's doing.
Do you approach kids' songs any – I mean, obviously the subject matter might be different, but do you approach the songwriting process any differently when you're writing for a younger audience than you do when you're writing a pop song that an adult audience might be listening to?
I don't. It's still – you know, getting up, getting into that space, get your cup of coffee or whatever and get an instrument and just start making stuff up and singing it. I really don't. I do know that I approach it absolutely the same as if I'm going, hey, this might be something great for Rihanna or this might be great for the Happy Racers. I approach the process the same, but I know that, and I've never been this focused with something, I know it's just a feeling like in my gut, like if I start playing something, I'm like, that's Happy Racers. I've never been so focused with something. Like I just know when it feels right. And then I'm on to it.
Well, you have something else from the new record you want to play?
This is a song that I like to play called Lullaby Dragon. I wrote it with my good friend Barbara Josie and my buddy Burton Collins back in Nashville. And it's on our record, and it's out kind of in conjunction with Barb's new book, Lullaby Dragon. And yeah, this is it.
Wishing for a dragon to chase the monsters beneath the bed in her room. In the dark. An all-alone dragon, alone in his cave. Wishing, oh, wishing for a girl he could save in her room. From the dark. Cried a silver tear that only dragons hear, and he rumbled and he roared till the monsters disappeared. No more nightmares when I sleep. Nevermore, nevermore. No more monsters in the deep. Nevermore, nevermore. No more lonely for a dragon, no more lonely for a girl. It's just you and me forever, forever, evermore. She sings her songs, lullaby songs. He thumps his tail with all his heart and sings along, loud and proud. And out of tune, she whispers in his ear, only secrets dragons hear. And he wraps his wings around her, so happy that she's near. No more nightmares when I sleep. Nevermore, nevermore. No more monsters in the deep. Nevermore, oh nevermore. No more lonely for a dragon, no more lonely for a girl. It's just you and me forever, forever, evermore. Forevermore. No more nightmares when I sleep. Nevermore. Not anymore. No more monsters in the deep. Nevermore, oh nevermore. No more lonely for a dragon, no more lonely for a girl. It's just you and me forever, forever, evermore. Best friends, best friends. Ha.
Oh, That's terrific.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
There are a lot of, as I'm sure you're aware, with as a parent of a couple of kids, there are a lot of efforts to hook kids on music. Do you – I mean we talked about this a little earlier. You know, are you subversively steering kids to a particular genre of music by playing the way you do?
I don't know if I'm that smart. You know, maybe. I think I've allowed myself to think that way a little bit, but at times, again, it's just kind of – I'm kind of waking up and making it up and riding it a little bit. If I'm steering them anywhere, I just hope that maybe I'm steering them to a place – there's a lot of people out there that are doing kids and family music and they're doing it great. I still feel like my niche is a little different than what everybody else is doing, and really sticking on that, this is not that far away from a AAA type thing. I ultimately would love to have a record that – that they spin on AAA, and then and families are listening to it Saturday mornings too.
It just happens to be about dragons,
right? It might be about dragons, you know. But there's a band out right now that's having a big hit called Imagine Dragons. You know, it's time, and so it's like maybe dragons are all the rage right now.
How did the collaboration with Barbara Josie come about?
Well, I have my father Mark Meckel to thank for that, and he had met her some time ago. So when we started putting the idea together, and I cut one or two tracks, I had a couple of tracks. He said, you know, I think that this lady's really cool and really talented, and she has never written songs before, but maybe it'd be cool if we maybe wrote something with her and maybe even put something with one of her books. And then, I mean, we just hit it off. You know, she's wildly creative. I love her. And I came up to Cedarburg when I was starting to work on the record, and we've written several songs together. I'm not sure what the number is, maybe four, five, six songs, something like that. So, yeah, I have my dad to thank for that.
And there is now an electronic or a virtual component to all of this as well.
Yeah, we got a really cool thing. We got asked to create like a theme song. I don't know that many apps have theme songs. And it's an interactive ebook that's designed for iPads, and it's called Go Go Greta. And a company approached us to do the theme song, and it's pretty cool. Lisa Loeb, the pop star, does all the narration, and they took my tracks and broke them down into stem mixes so you can kind of turn the drums off, the singer off, turn the guitars off, whatever, and it's a really cool little thing.
How much of what you end up recording is influenced by your own kids' tastes?
A lot. They're the beta testers, you know? They were there when I was making the first record, Ready, Set, Go. They were there. I have a really cool studio in my house. It's got its own little entrance and stuff. And I do a lot of start stuff there, like a lot of people do. It's my little laboratory. And then I'll go to another bigger studio and track some stuff and then bring it home and fiddle with it. But they're always kind of eavesdropping on what's happening there. And whenever they started smiling and laughing and giggling and dancing, you know, that's what I was like, okay, I'm onto it there.
They must think it's pretty cool to have a dad that's doing this.
Yeah, I don't know if they would tell you that every day. My son, maybe, because he's seven, so he's still younger. No, they really do. They do dig it.
When it comes to writing lyrics for kids, I mean, we think about adult pop songs, mm-hmm. and, you know, you can take them at face value, and sometimes there's something going on under the surface. You know, obviously, when you're writing a song like "Get Up and," you know, about getting up and moving,
sure.
It's pretty... pretty superficial,
right?
But do you strive to have more going on in your songs than maybe the average kid's song does?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. There's a time and place when if you're going to make a whole record and Happy Racer's going to make their next record, I don't want there to be 10 tracks on there that are thinky the whole way through. But I don't want there to be 10 tracks of fluff either. You know, you got to go out and play them live too, so you got to have some, you know, something that's fun. But absolutely, want to continue to talk up to the audience, my audience, whatever that is, and be smart about it and give something more to think about, you know, than just, you know, spoon feed and everything.
Well, you're doing a nice job. Nathan Meckel, thanks so much.
Thank you. So this next song I'm going to play, you know, the Happy Racers is like this, in my mind, is this great mix of something that kids love that doesn't, you know, annoy adults and parents. So, you know, a couple songs I play today are a little more maybe on that blur the line between AAA kind of music, singer-songwriter, pop rock stuff. And this one's definitely a little more for the kids, but it's, you know, it's a huge hit in the live shows, and it's very fun. And I know that the school my kids go to, their gym teachers love it. So it's called Move Your Body. Move your body, ready, set, go. Move your body, move your body, move your body more. Move your body, move your body, get on off the floor. Move your body, move your body, move your body.
Nathan Meckel is the man behind the Happy Racers, who will be playing at the Early Childhood Literacy Festival in Mequon tomorrow. A 6 p.m. concert at the Todd Weir Auditorium at Concordia University, Wisconsin is open to the public. There is more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect about tickets. As we listen to the Happy Racers, we'll take a short break and then return with the founder of the Milwaukee Comedy Festival, which also makes people happy. That's coming up next on Lake Effect from WUWM. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. It's great to have you with us. In 2006, Matt Kempel decided that what Milwaukee needed was a good laugh. And thus, the Milwaukee Comedy Festival was born. 8 years later, the festival has grown to be the largest of its kind in Wisconsin, and it now attracts acts from as far away as L.A., New York, and Vancouver. It continues to feature a broad range of comedic styles, from stand-up to sketch to improv, so there's something to appeal to just about everyone. Kempel joins me in the Lake Effect studio now. Matt, welcome back to Lake Effect. It's great to see you.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So, tonight, 8 years of Comedy Festival here in Milwaukee. Who'd have thought?
I never would have thought, that's for sure. I remember that first year. It was sort of just an experiment, a mistake almost, and a bunch of people showed up and had so much fun that, you know, we had to do it again and again and again.
And I think the first time I was acquainted with it was the second year you were at the Time Cinema.
Yes.
Doing it there. You've since moved down to Next Act space.
Yes.
And everything kicks off tonight. What are we expecting in this year's festival?
Well, my hope is, you know, fans of comedy, people that enjoy going out and seeing shows, they're going to still see something completely different from any other night of comedy. We try to offer a variety of different shows, you know, not just a stand-up show, not just sketch or improv comedy, but a mixture of that to sort of expose people to different kinds of comedy. And people that maybe don't see a lot of comedy shows, it's a great opportunity for them to get a lot of exposure to a lot of different types of fun.
Now, as the producer, how are you putting all of this together? I imagine that you're having to wade through lots and lots of video and lots of proposals.
Absolutely. The submission process starts in late January and early February, and there's a few months that we allow submissions. And this year we were literally overwhelmed with over 130 submissions from every corner of the United States. So previously we'd had, you know, maybe 60 submissions, 40 submissions. You know, in the early years we were really excited to get 20 or 30. And this year to have, you know, 130 plus was a major undertaking. Just the hours of footage, like you said, we try to give every single submission enough time to critique it accurately. And the biggest problem this year was almost every submission we got was high quality. And that doesn't usually happen. In years past, it's been pretty easy. Oh, you know, kind of half and half, or, you know, oh, these groups are okay, but not really what we're looking for. This year, pretty much everything was a 9 or a 10 on a scale of 1 to 10.
So you could have had like a 3-week festival.
We literally could. We were at the point where we almost needed to flip a coin, because the groups were so strong and so funny. How do you choose one funny over another? I mean, I thought I knew how. And this year it was really difficult. But, you know, at the same time, that's a really good problem to have.
So once you finally did make the decision, how did it fall out in terms of local acts versus national acts?
Well, we try to get as much of a mixture as we can. Every year of the festival, we try to have a focus on Milwaukee groups, and we did that again this year. But one sort of positive negative is there are a lot more groups in Milwaukee now performing comedy regularly, and we couldn't fit everybody from Milwaukee in. And that was really heartbreaking for us as the producers and the organizers of the festival. We want to include everybody, you know, a lot of our friends, we want to include them in the show, and it gets very difficult. How do you put a show together that's the best possible show that it can be, but you can't put a show on for your friends anymore necessarily?
That wasn't a quality issue, was it? Or
no, not really. It was just, again, the number of submissions that we got and just trying to have a variety. We couldn't have, you know, one show with three improv acts in it. We needed to have a mixture. So it got to the point where we had to make decisions based on really type of comedy, not necessarily level of good or bad, because they were all such quality submissions. It was, you know, much more about, okay, well, this style is a little bit different from what we already have on the docket. Or this type of improv, you just can't see this in Milwaukee, so we want to bring those folks into town, that type of thing.
Why do you think the festival is getting so much attention nationally? You're obviously on the radar now.
Yeah. I mean, this year, especially in years past, we've had a couple of rumblings, maybe somebody from New York one year, somebody from Dallas a different year, but never the same year. This year, every corner of the United States, we got submissions from LA, New York, San Francisco, Florida, New Hampshire, and all these cities in between, and Vancouver, Canada, and Toronto, Canada as well. The thing that I can only base it off of what I see in the submissions. We ask, how did you hear about the festival? And about half of the submissions referred to another group that said, hey, this group had so much fun, they told us about it. Another one said, we've been watching you for a while from afar and realized that you really have something special. Another group said, you know, everybody we've talked to says Milwaukee Comedy Festival is the place to be. And to me, that is the true level of success for what I'm trying to do. Because when I started this, it was all about trying to put on a quality show that was entertaining, that was fun for the audience, but it also had to be fun for the performers. And to me, this is a real example of the performers are having such a great time. They're telling their friends and their colleagues, hey, you guys need to check this out because, you know, they treat us well. It's a blast, and there's not really anything quite like this happening as far as the comedy festival circuit's concerned.
So you found a niche, it sounds like.
I think so, and not even trying to find one. I didn't set out and say, okay, this is how my festival's different from others. I came to producing as a performer. So I knew what a performer needed to have a great show, at least ideally. So when
Like what?
Well, part of it is a lot of festivals are focused on sort of on the money side of things, where it is a money-making venture that there are, in some cases and in some cities, thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people coming and major corporate sponsors and huge overhead. And the bottom dollar is extremely important, or you can't do it again the next year. And with the Milwaukee Comedy Festival, it's all been very grassroots, partly because I didn't know how to ask for sponsorships, for one, in those early years. And also, I just, from putting on my own shows theatrically and small comedy shows, it was like, okay, well, what can we afford to do? All right, let's try to do everything we can with, you know, as little resources as we have. And that's sort of just how the festival's been built up. We still have, you know, a small number of resources, but we're able to utilize them in the best way we can. We're able to try to do more with less. So by approaching the festival in that way, there's, I think, this level, sort of what other performers have said to me in years past is just the way that they're treated, for one. We offer free food and beverages backstage because we can't really pay the performers what they deserve to be paid. So by offering free food and, you know, they can see shows for free and stuff like that, it becomes this community where funny people are able to connect with other funny people that they wouldn't necessarily have an opportunity to converse with or to work with on stage. So it's exciting over the years to see, you know, some familiar faces, some people that are really fun to work with backstage and on stage. That's an exciting place to be. And I think that's really what has caused the popularity, at least in the internal comedy scene. So people are saying, hey, you know, Milwaukee, it's a cool city. There's a lot more to do there than we would have thought outside of Milwaukee. And the people there are really nice. And we get that a lot. The staff that you hire are some of the nicest people we've ever met. And just that little option of somebody who spent all day traveling on their own dime to come and perform a show for you, I think the least I can do is be nice to them. And to a lot of these people coming in from out of town, it's sort of like a band going on tour. It's a lot of long hours, a lot of miles in between shows. And to treat somebody like a human being and to treat somebody like a friend is really welcoming and really satisfying when you're tired and don't really feel very funny that day.
What about Milwaukee audiences? Have they embraced this idea, and are you getting feedback from them that they're enjoying some things that they might not see otherwise?
Absolutely. That's another thing that's kind of been fascinating is the, you know, a few years ago it stopped being all my friends that were coming to see the festival. And now there's all these people from all over Milwaukee, greater Milwaukee. I mean, Grafton and Mequon and Brown Deer and Racine. These outlying areas are all finding out about the festival and having a great time and seeing these shows. And I don't know who any of these people are. And that's really exciting. And a lot of other comedians in town have commented that they have said, you know, oh, we couldn't do these kinds of shows that we do throughout the year if it wasn't for the comedy festival. And to me, that's a real honor for somebody to say, you know, I set out and said, hey, there isn't a huge comedy scene here from what I can tell. It'd be really great if we could do something special that would draw that focus. And that's really what the first comedy festival was all about. So to see that idea expanded and over the course of 8 years, having comedians come up to me and literally thank me for what I'm doing. And I mean, the funny thing to me is I just like to laugh. And, you know, all this time, that was sort of the mission. Well, we really love to laugh. Let's have a great time. And then this underlying mission of creating an environment where it's fun and safe to be funny is sort of a unique idea, and it's caught on. And now there's this really incredible comedy scene in town. A lot of kind of underground shows are sort of coming out of the woodwork, and now you can catch monthly showcases all the time. Every single week there's some kind of a focus on local comedy. And in every single little community, you know, Bayview, River West, the East Side, they all have these little comedy scenes that are starting to pop up, and these comedians are getting up and trying new things and pursuing comedy as a career. And 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago, there was no possibility of doing that with any sort of community assistance or any sort of support from friends or family. And now
maybe even community awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's really where the first Comedy Fest came from. Was I saw all these groups, they were performing, it looked like a lot of fun. So we thought, okay, let's put them all together. Let's put a big show on, call it the first annual comedy festival as a joke, and see who shows up.
And 8 years later, here you are.
And 8 years later, I'm still crazy enough to keep doing it.
Do you see a particular trend or trends in comedy, both here in Milwaukee and also nationwide? Are there specific types of humor that seem to be popular right now?
There is this interesting sort of a Milwaukee style that's starting to come out. When we watched the submission tapes, it was sort of fascinating. We'd be watching something and think, oh, this has to be Chicago. Oh, this has to be New York. You know, and you start to see those videos over and over again. And then watching local shows, we're starting to see, oh, there's sort of this style that's starting to come out. I can't really define it, but it's there. And it's exciting to see that Milwaukee's growing in that kind of way where it can be recognized like that.
So there's an actual Milwaukee brand of comedy.
I think so, yeah.
And you'll get a chance to see it this weekend.
Absolutely.
Matt Kempel, as always, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Matt Kempel is the founder of the Milwaukee Comedy Festival, now in its 8th year. It all gets underway tonight at Next Act Theater in the 5th Ward, and it runs through the weekend. There's more information at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And that is all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. It's 11 o'clock.